This is Your Call. I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar. San Francisco Women Against Rape is celebrating 50 years of service. In 1973, a group of San Francisco women had had enough of sexual violence, of its ugly assertion of power. They set out to help women reclaim that power. Led by rape survivors, they set out to organize. Even in that revolutionary time when black, brown, and feminist movements were rising, it was still radical for women, or anyone, to pull sexual assault out of the shadows and fight back. SF War began modestly, just a crisis hotline, just 20 hours a week. It has certainly evolved. They reached out to government institutions and eventually partnered with San Francisco. And putting their own rhetoric into action, they transformed into a women of color-led organization. SF War's work is more important than ever. A report in January found there have been 65,000 pregnancies from rape in states where abortion is banned. As we all know, even travel to safe states is under attack and impossible for many women. The numbers have increased since that January report. To mark this anniversary, SF War is releasing a feature-length video, and they have a live event April 26th at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. We're going to talk about the past, present, and future of SF War. Joining us via Zoom is Janelle White, Executive Director of the organization. She's worked in the anti-rape movement for 30 years in Michigan, New Orleans, and since 2006 as a faculty lecturer at the San Francisco State and Women's Gender Studies program. She's teaching classes on women and the prison industrial complex, the history of American women. Janelle White, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you so much, Angie, for having us. Thank you.
And with us, too, for the discussion is Alicia Maldonado. She's Director of Community Initiatives, and she's been with the organization since 2012. Her work centers on serving survivors and allies in communities at the intersection of multiple forms of oppression. She coordinates programs providing education, tools for healing and response, leadership building, and community organization. We're going to hear more about those programs and more than that today. Alicia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Angie.
So it's always a good idea to start out with terminology. There's a note here that the label rape survivors or sexual violence survivor does have its detractors, but this is SF War's language from its literature, and that's what we'll be using this hour. That said, the very definition of rape has matured. Janelle, compare with what we know today about sexual assault versus some of the misapprehensions back in the day, 1973, when this all started.
Thanks, Angie. In 1973, I would have been, how old was I? 5 years old. So just saying, I've been in the movement 30 years, but I'm a later starter than when SF War was founded in 1973. So I would say we've come a long way, right? Mm-hmm. But there's still some serious stereotypes, misconceptions, and downright falsehoods about what sexual assault is. And sadly, we still have a very racialized impression of what sexual assault is. So often dating back to after Reconstruction. And so very much what Professor Angela Davis calls the myth of the black male rapist. Mm-hmm. And with that comes the white female victim, right? And
yes,
that is the normally thought of as what rape is. Rape happens in that dynamic. And so there's a lot of misinformation and racialization around rape still today, sadly. So I would start there in terms of kind of what we historically in the United States have been working with in terms of understandings about sexual assault.
Are there problems still with the way that legislation is worded in terms of what a rape is and who's a rape survivor and, you know, who's guilty, that sort of thing? Are there still efforts to rebrand some of this legislation and make it more accurate and more helpful?
You know, I think that's a good question. I do think there is still some work that needs to be done about what actually constitutes sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
there's definitely legalistic understanding. So, of course, if a survivor decides to report a sexual assault to law enforcement, you know, there's certain ways in which sexual assault is defined or not defined. So that, you know, we always work under that umbrella. But I think what's more important to me, Angie, in terms of the survivors we work at SF War, you know, we understand, survivors understand, and individuals understand when there has been coercion or there's not consent and sexual interaction. And so, you know, we want folks not to be kind of parsing, is this a legal rape, right? Mm-hmm. Would law enforcement define this as rape? If someone feels like they have experienced any kind of coercion that has to do with unwanted touching, you know, any of the things, we want them to call us and get support because they deserve it. You know, so so I think that becomes much more important for us than trying to figure out, does this fit within the realms of however law enforcement or the law defines sexual assault? So I don't know if that's helpful. And I think so often we get caught up on, does this count legally? And I think that to me matters very little. It much more matters what individuals' experience is and if they feel like they were consenting in an interaction or if they were not. So really want to focus back on consent, affirmative consent, all of those kinds of things.
Well, this is a good time to put out the hotline phone number, and I'll be doing that a couple of times this hour. 415-647-RAPE is the hotline number if you need the assistance. 415-647-RAPE. So much else that SF War does: advocacy, counseling for survivors, and personal accompaniment at the Rape Treatment Center at San Francisco General Hospital. Alicia, we're going to get to education in just a moment and community initiatives. Let me stay with Janelle and ask, walk me through the experience. I'm a woman who calls and says, I've been raped, I've been assaulted. Walk me through the steps of what I can expect.
That's a really good question, Angie, and important for folks to know. The most important thing that I'm going to want to focus on with someone who calls me is their immediate safety. You know, are you calling from a safe place right now? If you are not, then that's going to be the priority, is to ensure that we get that individual to a safe place, and then we can continue talking, right? Mm-hmm. So safety is always paramount when and any of the calls that we take on the hotline, anyone we're talking to. So once that's established, then it's about talking about what the individual wants to do. You know, we've always been based in the idea that it has to be the survivor's decision, that the survivor has to have agency in anything that happens. So someone might decide that they want to go to General Hospital to get a rape kit done, to get medical attention, and that's a perfectly fine path if that's what someone chooses. Mm. Other folks might say, no, I absolutely don't want to do that, or I don't want to go to General Hospital. Could I go to my doctor? Is that a possibility? We'll talk them through what that means if that's an option that they choose. It's so important that survivors be given the opportunity to use their own agency as opposed to us telling them what they should do, like that you must go to the hospital or you must make a report. We do want to lay out all the options on the table so they can make an informed decision about what will be best for them. Mm-hmm. And that's always been what we've been predicated on. And we can support along the way. So, you know, if people do decide they would like to go to General Hospital, we can provide support there. We can talk about how the Rape Treatment Center also provides, that the Trauma and Recovery Center also provides support there, what that is going to look like. We can lay out all of those things. What is it going to look like if you decide you might want to report? What are the things to consider? Mm-hmm. What concerns? So we really want to give people kind of a space to consider all the options in a non-judgmental kind of way. Mm-hmm. So important. And to let people know they're not alone. You know, that's so important. As a sexual assault survivor myself, mm-hmm. I think so often we feel like we can't talk about this. No one wants to hear about it because it's too hard. And so to know that you can talk to someone on a hotline where everything is going to be anonymous, confidential, if that's what you'd like, and just get the information, get your feelings out, really figuring out where you, what you want to do. It's such an important service. It really, really is. I wish when I never utilized a hotline when I, after my assault. I did get support services a couple years after the assault, but I think my healing would have looked different had I had more immediate support. And so it makes a huge impact. It really does.
That's the voice of Janelle White, SFWAR's executive director. Let me turn now to Alicia Maldonado, director of community initiatives. Alicia, there's so much going on at SFWAR. There's the focus on prevention and education. One of the things I want to ask about, and I'll show my card since Janelle did hers, I was 12 in 1973, and I was already aware at that young age that if you went out somewhere at night, you were to thread your car keys or your home keys through your fist so that if you had to hit somebody, you know, you have that extra power across the street when a man is there. I'm sure we've come a long way. So talk about the education and prevention that SFWAR provides now.
Thank you so much, Angie. Yeah, absolutely. We provide prevention education. I think that's been a really foundational piece of SFWAR and something that arises out of our mission. You know, we don't just want to respond to sexual violence when it occurs. We want to transform the systems of oppression that enable you know, and utilize violence in order to maintain power. And so prevention is a really key part of that. You know, we have to change cultural messaging around rape and sexual assault. We have to change the practices within interpersonal relationships and the, you know, the policies and as well that, you know, support survivors through, you know, what the education that they get, the aftermath of surviving sexual assault. So now what we do, you know, is we have, since the 90s, have had a prevention education program. We work with not just youth at a middle school and high school level throughout all of San Francisco, in schools, through San Francisco Unified School District, private schools, as well as community-based organizations. But we also present to adults. We do staff trainings, and we do a number of different topics, not just related to sexual assault, but sexual harassment prevention, bystander intervention, healthy relationships, anti-oppression. So we do a great number of topics, as well as prevention-based support groups, peer education. So we've really, really grown in what we provide in our prevention education to all ages, really recognizing that, you know, there are different life stages for folks in having access to this information. And as you mentioned, Angie, I mean, there are, you know, adults who, you know, had risk reduction of how to protect yourself from rape as, you know, growing up. I know I definitely heard messages like that, but now we also are in an era of affirmative consent education where what is being taught and mandated around sexual assault prevention education is yes means yes. So, you know, really looking at how do we all participate in getting yes, getting permission and checking in with each other and having mutual understanding during sexual interactions at every step of the way.
I'm curious about what the experience is like with that when you're dealing with middle and high school students. Is a person that age receptive to yes means yes, no means no? Do they get that and do they accept that?
I would say yes. I've been doing, you know, prevention education, you know, at SFWAR since 2012 and even before that with doing specifically sexual assault prevention education workshops in San Francisco. And certainly there's been a shift. I would say now when you ask what consent is, you know, students know, young people know, you know, oh, you know, consent is permission. You know, consent is saying yes, it's being enthusiastic. I mean, there are acronyms for, you know, how to remember the aspects of consent, you know, that it is freely given, that it's by choice, that, you know, it's revocable, that you can change your mind. So, you know, I think the idea of the norm of that consent and saying yes and that you have the right to your boundaries is something that is definitely more, it's more natural. It's accepted as something that, well, this is kind of what is supposed to be. Of course, you know, in practice, it is something that is hard, and the, you know, education of it across every school and every, you know, young space. You know, we're talking about the kind of equity of health classes and who gets it and when, but, you know, the, it's definitely more accepted as this is supposed to be part of the interaction, which I think is certainly different, than, you know, previously and what I learned. I definitely learned no means no. And now it's definitely a shift.
I want to stay with you, Elisa, for a moment, because we're going to be talking about the political arena and the political milieu we live in right now. And I find myself wondering, when I read about the classes for middle school and high school children, it made me nervous immediately to think about the, they call it, the anti-woke movement. And part of that mentality is returning children and young adults to this image of chaste people who don't need to think about sex, who shouldn't be thinking about sex. Is that a factor in the San Francisco Bay Area?
You know, I, not so much. I have not really experienced that reaction. As a matter of fact, in, you know, the public school district, there is, you know, a curriculum that, you know, includes sexual assault prevention education. In California, of course, that is, something that, you know, is a mandate to have, as part of a health requirement. And, you know, I think within, when we're talking about kind of anti-woke, you know, pushback, certainly recognizing that the acceptance of consent and affirmative consent, you know, I recognize we are in San Francisco and in the Bay Area with a bubble within a bubble within California's bubble, right, within the nation. I don't think it necessarily, the acceptance of that here reflects, you know, even a statewide or even a nationwide sentiment. But in the Bay Area, there is a curriculum, like, you know, written curriculum in health classes to at the high school level to include sexual assault prevention education. And that is something that, you know, is students need to take. And so it certainly is privilege, I think, here to be able to have that as a prevention educator, you know, going in, not having to experience, you know, a resistance to that. Is it comfortable? No, it's not always comfortable. But, you know, I don't think conversations are around power and, you know, how power plays out in this kind of way is always comfortable. And I also think that within this, our education, you know, moving this conversation away from, you know, this is not talking about being anti-rape, is not talking about sex. You know, it is talking about violence. It is talking about an act of violence committed against someone using sex as a weapon. And so I think if we look at that, if we focus on, you know, violence, how power is playing out in these interactions, and then how rape has been used historically as a tool of power, we, you know, are moving away from that discomfort more to, you know, what is our role as a culture, as a society, to break down rape culture, and not looking at, well, you know, this is a misunderstanding between two people about one person said yes, one person said no. We're moving away from that message into how is power used in this acts of rape.
This is reassuring to hear. I'm really glad that the political side of it is at least not an issue there. Janelle, are there political attacks aimed directly at SF Warren? And the reason I bring that up is because, you know, there's the anti-woke movement, and there's obviously, we're going to talk about this further, a move against abortion in general and the curbing of women's rights in general. Are there political considerations for SF Warren, or are you more or less free to go about your work? Because we're in a fairly liberal area.
That's a very good question, Angie, and definitely having done work in the South in New Orleans for the years that I was there, the terrain does look different here than working there. But in some ways, it's still the same. I did want to make one comment that just, I feel like I was having a bit of my hairs on fire moment, because if consent is considered woke, How problematic is that, right? If, you know, so if when consent gets, you know, to me, consent should be something that we should not have to have a debate about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the notion is that is an anti-woke sentiment and we need to push back against consent, again, it just makes my head spin. It really, really does. So if anti-woke is anti-consent, well, I tell that immediately I know what side I'm on. And you know, and what the right side of history is, right? If there was ever any question, but so that, yeah, I just had to think about that for a bit because that is really kind of what is juxtaposed. But there really, should there be some kind of should we be in a debate about sexual assault? You know, really, are we? There's a part of me that feels like this should just be an unconditional understanding that yes, sexual assault is never acceptable, mm-hmm. never. Irregardless, and consent should be what we as a world would want to achieve, right?
Yes.
If we globally could get behind that, if we could end rape, that would be the way we end it, right?
Mm-hmm.
To get everyone to kind of commit to that understanding. And I know we still have a long way to go, but in the 50 plus years that the anti-rape movement has been, you know, active in the United States, we have done phenomenal work. You know, in 1970, there were no rape crisis centers.
Wow.
Yeah, there were nothing. In 1971, the first two rape crisis centers, Bay Area Women Against Rape and the Washington, D.C. Rape Crisis Center were established. And so just think about that. It wasn't that people were not doing anti-rape work, because we've got some amazing shoulders to stand on, like Ida B. Wells Barnett, like Rosa Parks, who was doing, you know, folks who were doing anti-rape work, although it wasn't called that.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, right? But then, you know, here comes the formal anti-rape movement in 1971 into the United States. So what we've accomplished from 71 to present is phenomenal in terms of the configurations. I mean, California has a rape crisis center in every county, and Alameda has two rape crisis centers. So that is in that amount of time.
It's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. So the social movement really did produce. And now I think where we are is really trying to figure out how, as a really progressive social movement, we've shifted, right, from this anti-oppression philosophy, recognizing rape as a tool of oppression, a weapon of oppression, as Alicia was talking about, moving more into a more professionalized social service network. And what does that mean in terms of our political power? I have a colleague that I'm very close to, Jamie Lee Evans, who is a former SF warrior. It's going to be recognized at our anniversary event as part of our kitchen table conversation that dropped today. And Jamie and I go back and forth about, is there really an anti-rape movement anymore? Or is it just kind of this network of social service providers? And what does that mean if we've lost that? If
yes.
We've lost kind of that kind of movement, because that's what got us to where we are today. So I think there's a lot of thinking and considerations that the current configuration of the rape crisis network has to be kind of thinking about. And I know that things change over historical time. Nothing's going to stay the same. But I hope that we have not, I worry that we've lost some of the most powerful pieces, our theory, our understanding, our practice, our action, direct action, that we've lost some of that as we've moved along through the decades.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. I don't think I answered your question at all, Angie. I got really about consent being anti-woke, and I, you know, I have to go there.
That's quite a, you know, and we're going to get back to what you and I were just going to talk about, so don't worry about that. That's Janelle White. She's SF War's Executive Director, and she teaches at SF State classes on women and the prison industrial complex, the history of African-American women as well. Alicia Maldonado is on the line, Director for SF4 of Community Initiatives. She's been with the organization since 2012. We're going to take a wee break here and then come on back on your call. I'm Angie Coiro in for Rose today. When we do come back, we'll be talking about the celebration, 50 years, and we'll be letting you know how you can take part in that and more about the politics of what goes into work with rape. And we're going to be talking, too, about more of the tools that are available from SF War. We want to hear from you. The phone lines are open, 866-798-8255. Maybe you have a direct connection with SF War as a volunteer or worked with them over the past 50 years. Did it change your outlook as a feminist, as an activist, or just as a human being? We would love to hear your stories. What kind of connection do you have to rape survivors, and how has that changed your outlook or your look at the human race? What kind of conversations about rape do you have with people in your life? Well, do you have them at all, for one thing? And if you do, especially with young people, boys, girls, how do you talk about it, especially when it feels very hard to do? And if you don't, what would it take to get you to have those conversations? All of those topics are open for you and anything else related to SF War. Again, the number is 866-798-8255. I'm Angie Coyro. This is Your Call. We'll be right back. This is Your Call. I'm Angie Coyro. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of SF War and the issues the organization still faces in educating people about rape and in assisting rape survivors. I'm going to take a little detour into something much more pleasant, and that is the upcoming event on April 26th. Let me get right out in the front that you can get complete information at sfwar.org, sfwar.org. Now, this event on April 26th is a fundraiser. There will be speakers, performances, food. It's at the San Francisco Ferry Building. Alicia Maldonado, what am I leaving out there?
Thank you so much, Angie. Our 50th anniversary is going to be at the Ferry Building. It's going to be a wonderful event called Rooted in Social Justice, Striving for Collective Liberation. We are going to be screening a portion of our pre-recorded kitchen table with Barbara Smith, Loretta Ross, and Jamie Lee Evans. Mm-hmm. There will also be a live Q&A with Jamie Lee Evans and Loretta Ross. We're also going to be having Toshi Regan and Big Lovely with music, and it's going to be, you know, a wonderful celebration. We'll have vegan hood chefs as well, and just really, you know, having a moment of upholding the history of the anti-rape movement. And then also having a chance to, you know, get together and celebrate and your resilience, celebrate 50 years, celebrate, you know, progress and, you know, our future as well. So, you know, it's having some celebration in times like this and for all the work, you know, that has been put into this is also a wonderful, opportunity. Janelle's been working very hard on this event as well. And Janelle, if you have other things that you wanted to add onto the event as well, you know, she's definitely deep into making this happen.
Janelle?
Thank you, Alicia. Alicia knows it's been many months of working every day of the week. I really want to think of this as my love letter to SF War. One of the things Alicia didn't mention, but I really want to hold up, is the way we work at SF War is we work in community. We would not be able to do the range of things we do if we did not have community partners that we turn to or mentors that we turn to for support and to help build the work. And so there are some awards that we are going to be doing too at the event. The California Coalition for Women Prisoners is going to be recognized for their phenomenal work supporting survivors inside and just naming the expansiveness of sexual violence happening to incarcerated women identified folks and gender expansive folks. And that's so important. Also, I have to say this, Diana Block, who is one of the founders of San Francisco Women Against Rape, is mm-hmm. also a co-founder of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. Of course she is. the work is very connected. And so being able to award CCWP a Community and Solidarity Award is really important to us, and so happy to be able to recognize them. We are also recognizing the Queer Women of Color Media Arts Project, who's been a longtime partner with SF4. One of the founders, co-founders of Quack Map, Kibo Drew, my sister friend who goes back to the late 90s. We were part of SF4 then. We started the Women of African Descent Task Force together with a cadre of other amazing women of African descent. The awards are so important. We're recognizing Loretta Ross as one of the first Black women to direct a rape crisis center in the United States, starting in the late 70s. There's just a lot of historical pieces of the work that need to get held up and not lost. Mm-hmm. And so this anniversary is really about making sure that we don't, our collective memory does not get lost, and how important it is. And I just can't wait to see former SF warriors, current SF warriors, volunteers, staff, board, clients, survivors, community members I haven't seen in years. I'm just so excited. I really am. and can't wait.
I can't tell.
Yes, can you tell? I'm a little loopy, right? But I really am looking forward to this. It's going to be a joyous evening celebration. And, especially coming after the pandemic, I think we've been so disconnected. So to be able to have this moment of in-person celebration, but we are also live streaming. So if you are not in the Bay and you have a connection to SF War, you can live stream on our website and be part of it too. That way we really wanted to make it as accessible to as many people as possible.
And I will note, as someone who's done a lot of fundraising myself, just because you're live streaming doesn't mean you can't donate. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes, there you go. Absolutely, Angie. Absolutely.
I do want to get more into the history. And that is because the founders and the early staffers were largely white women. And there was that effort to pass the torch to women of color. And that's been successful. SF4 is now a women of color-led organization. Talk about, Janelle, that shift over time, what the challenges were, how long it took. How did that process go?
That's a great question. This is one of the, I study the anti-rape movement and the battered women's movement. And let me tell you, this is, a story that's, I think, really, really important to know. So, it was a commitment from the beginning, Angie, from, when Diana Block and the other co-founders kind of came together and saw that they were mostly white women, recognizing there was a way in which many, while white women experience sexual violence, absolutely, women who are at the intersection of multiple systems of oppression often are the most targeted and the most vulnerable. And they realize that early on. And they realize the racism of law enforcement response to especially women of color who had been raped or had defended themselves against a rape. And then all of a sudden are incarcerated for that or arrested for self-defense, right? They recognize these things. So they knew that it was really important not just to include some of the most marginalized women, especially women of color, but to really take a step back and allow for women of color to lead the work so that we could work in our own communities. This isn't charity work. This is community. So I want to work in communities that I'm a part of. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to go out and help these poor survivors. I am a survivor. I am a woman of African descent. I want to work in Black communities and queer communities. I want to work where I feel commitment. And I feel all of us in SF4 have that feeling, right? We want to go to those places where some of the most marginalized folks are not getting the support that they need and deserve, and have a lot of really important solutions to addressing sexual violence. And we want to partner with them because that's the way we're going to end rape. And mm-hmm. ultimately, as much as it's joyous that we are celebrating 50 years of work, I would love to be celebrating that we are closing the doors. We have ended this issue. We are done. And we can move on to do other work. We're not quite there yet, But we will keep on working towards that goal. That is really the vision of SF4, is to not have to do this work anymore. So, you know, we actually became women of color led at every level of the organization in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
We first became a majority women of color board. That's where it kind of started in the 80s. In the 90s, the staff started to become majority women of color, the volunteer pool. And then by 2000, we hired our first woman of color executive director. So it took some decades to get there. Every level of the organization now, we are seeing ourselves as being we are majority women of color, and it's just an important commitment. The anti-rape movement must be rooted in anti-racism. Mm-hmm. It just must be, and it has to take a political position on racism. Has to acknowledge that it exists, right? Just like we acknowledge that misogyny and sexism and patriarchy give rise to sexual violence and gender-based violence, we have to recognize that racism does the same thing. Anti-immigrant sentiment does the same thing. So we have to constantly be having that analysis if we want to get to the goal of ending rape, right? So, I have very warm relationships with a lot of the white women that came in the 80s and the 90s who I worked with. And I look to them for support. Rebecca Rolfe is someone who was our executive director for years. She started as a volunteer. She was our first executive director. Now she is the director of the SF LGBT center. She's someone who's so important to this history. So Diana Block, who I mentioned. So there are white women. Kate Raphael, another person. Lisa Rudman, some amazingly important white women who have really led with the idea of leading from behind. Mm-hmm. It's really, think about Ella Baker there, right? Like in some ways that's hard, right? Because I think many people might feel like, no, this is my work. I want to do this work. I need to be front and center.
Right.
But all of those women were very clear, like, no, absolutely. There's a role for me here, but it may not be a leadership role, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's astounding, vision there. There's also a real embodiment of anti-racist practice, mm-hmm. Among all of them. So that is so important for us to be able to be where we are today. If we did not have white women who were, you know, rooted in anti-racism themselves, there's no way I think that SF4 would be who we are right now.
Yeah, and you know, considering how long it took, even so, for it to have come into the conversation so early, put the organization ahead of its time. Alicia, I don't want to leave you out on this. I'm sure that you probably have some thoughts on what we're talking about as well. And I want to go to you specifically on one thing I'm hearing throughout, and that is, well, first of all, the event we're talking about is rooted in social justice, striving for collective liberation. We've been talking about bystander involvement. We've been talking about community involvement. Can you talk to me about the place of people who are neither rape survivors nor directly involved with SF4? Tell me where they fall in this picture to be supportive, and even how you get them involved. Can you tackle that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I think it's a great question, and one that, you know, I run into a lot in prevention education as well. You know, if I'm not directly impacted by the issue of sexual harassment or assault, why should I care about this? Well, I think if we start looking at sexual violence as interconnected to all forms of violence and oppression, we start to see that we all have a role, right? Because we all have a role in creating the messages of the culture of rape. So if, you know, the messages of, do we believe survivors? You know, I think that's something that, no matter, you know, we have long fought for, you know, the institutional policies or the, you know, education that's in schools or the, you know, supportive systems that are in place for survivors. But, you know, there are a lot of messages between individuals about when someone you know is actually assaulted, are you going to believe them, right? If they're sexually harassed, are you going to still support them if it didn't, you know, rise to the level of a rape or sexual assault? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that we all can be mindful of how we support survivors. You know, but I never met a survivor that didn't have to hear, you know, I believe you, you know, what do you need? How can I, you know, support your safety? I think that is, you know, one place that we always want to kind of just assume that when we're talking about this issue, that there is a survivor in the room. So even if you are not a survivor yourself, if you don't, you know, think that you know survivors, you know, whatever issue is important to you, there is a connection to sexual assault and anti-sexual assault work, you know, whether that's workers' rights, immigrants' rights, just housing, you know, all of this has a connection to violence. And I think the more that we make those interconnections, the stronger all of our movements are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we do not see our issue, you know, of being a rape crisis center as, oh, it's a singular issue. It is not. And I think that the more that we can bring folks into, you know, seeing that, you know, this is a form of violence that, like all forms of violence, you know, are interconnected with one another and harm all of our community, the more that we can bring people into this conversation. And when they don't, you know, feel like they know a survivor, and that they are not one, you know, and in addition to that, I think just the way that the culture, you know, of, you know, the jokes we tell, the messages that we, you know, may support, the teachings, you know, to one another. I think those are important as well. Our interpersonal communications to each other, the way that we practice boundaries, you know, and just utilizing consent, you know, in all aspects of our lives, I think can also be an important factor to teach. Cause it keeps us in practice, you know, with boundaries with one another and just ensuring that we, can see the value in when a survivor, you know, does come forward in our life or when someone, you know, discloses that, you know, we have that empathy and that fundamental understanding, that we all deserve, you know, choice, in our lives and in our decisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit about what comes to mind.
Alicia, let me stay with you because I understand that there's outreach as well to people who are in unstable home situations, either fully homeless or in danger of becoming homeless. It's remarkable and wonderful that there's outreach to a group that's so largely disenfranchised, so largely seen as not quite human. Tell me what the involvement is there of SF4 and the homeless or near homeless population.
Yeah, so we at SF4 have for a long time done homeless marginally housed outreach, and we have had a peer-to-peer program where we have trained folks to go, you know, go through rape crisis counselor training to be able to do SRO outreach. Before the pandemic, we were doing SRO outreach in the Mission, single room occupancy, hotel outreach in the Mission with Women's Community Clinic. We, even through the pandemic and for many years, over 18 years now, have done monthly outreach with homeless and marginally housed women at Ladies Night and at Mission Neighborhood Resource Center, which is on Cap Street between 16th and 17th on Thursdays. And essentially looking, you know, this is a community where, you know, we have recognized that you need to meet folks, you know, survivors where they are. Homeless and marginally housed women are a group, one of our prioritized communities that, you know, experience high rates of sexual violence and mm-hmm. targeting for all sorts of violence and high barriers to support. Even, you know, not having basic needs met means that accessing supportive services, even like, you know, a hotline if you don't have a phone or, you know, engaging in counseling if you don't have, you know, clothes or, you know, just basic needs and just worrying about where your next, you know, what your next day is going to be like, that becomes extremely hard. So part of our programming is to, you know, provide clothing, basic necessity, resource bags, in partnership with these other organizations. We also have had partnerships with Mission Neighborhood Resource Center of collaborating on a healthy relationships curriculum. That was something that we were able to, present at their alternship training. And so we've had a long time relationship with community partners to essentially just meet survivors who are homeless, women where they are, you know, in accessing services, and just where they are in their life and in their healing process. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to ask both of you about some of the language that's arisen around the exceptions for rape in banning abortions, states banning or restricting abortions. And when the question of exceptions for rape come up, there's some really outrageous stuff out there. In February in Missouri, when the exception was being debated, Republican Senator, State Senator Bill Eigel said, I'm quoting here, "I don't support the institutions of rape or incest." Once you've swallowed that one, we're going to go on and say that he opposes services for rape survivors. This is according to Salon.com. He falsely claimed allowing child rape victims to get abortion would lead them to commit suicide, saying, "I can't imagine Missouri will be a better place tomorrow if we have individuals inflicting abortion on kids, and that a one-year-old could get an abortion if exceptions were allowed." Janelle,
I don't even know where to begin on that. But you know what? I was thinking, should I claim that I was actually born in Missouri and lived there for many years?
I wouldn't.
This harkens back. I don't know what it is about Missouri, but I remember, I think his name was Todd Akins. He was running for senator against Claire McCaskill. He also had this ridiculous idea that, you know, pregnancy did not stem from rape because there was a way, a woman's body, if it was forced, if the sexual intercourse was forced, her body would shut down. That's his. Shut down the rape, any pregnancy from happening through rape. I have no idea. And what's even worse is I believe he is a physician. Like, he's a medical doctor, right? And so I have no idea where this comes from. It's so oppressive and so ridiculous in so many different ways. And that's all I can really say. There's no evidence. There's nothing that's going to show that there's an increased rate of suicidality among folks who have abortion or younger people. There's nothing there. So all of this is ridiculousness as a way to basically continue to have power over who are choices of individuals who are pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is what we're seeing across, I feel like, across the board, especially in the Midwest and in the Deep South. And it's deeply troubling. What's happening in Arizona recently, deeply troubling. And I know California, especially San Francisco City and County, is very proactively responding to make sure those folks who do not have access to abortion, to the health care that they require, are able to access that here in our state. And I'm so thankful for that. But I have such concern for the folks who are needing to access abortion because of a sexual assault, who can't or want to and they cannot. That is deeply disheartening. It's heartbreaking. It is really heartbreaking, Angie. And that's all I can say. And I want to apologize for Missouri. I really do.
I'm from Indiana. I have no room to criticize. No room at all. Alicia, because of this happening in other parts of the country, do you get inquiries about SF4's programs from other states, or do you hear from women in other states who've been assaulted elsewhere? Are they calling to find out how to handle things?
We do get calls from folks out of state. I wouldn't say that we are necessarily getting calls specifically just around this at an increased rate, but we do get folks from other states. And, you know, usually we do try to refer folks to their most local rape crisis area, just because there are legal differences in even various counties, right, within California and from state to state. And I think that, you know, something that really highlights is, you know, the need to continue to have these rape crisis centers, and their services, because, you know, again, all these issues are interconnected. And, you know, I'm of a generation where, you know, I always had a legal abortion a legal right to abortion, right? Mm-hmm. I have not lived in a time, right, remembered a time where an abortion was not legal. I grew up in California. I'm originally from San Diego. think that like someone in my generation, until something like what we have been seeing across the nation and from state to state with restrictions and bans on abortion happens, you almost take it for granted, you know, until those services are gone. And I think that's, similar to, as Janelle mentioned earlier, rape crisis centers were not always around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there are times like this where you see the need and the rise for the need of rape crisis services in areas, especially that have very high threats to rights and why we need them, and that we shouldn't take them for granted, and we should fight to keep them funded and keep them open because of these very interconnections. We do get calls from other places, from out of county, out of state, and there is a great need to make sure that folks in their local areas have access to their local services, because, you know, as much as we can emotionally support somebody from another state, having, you know, the access to resources where they are, mm-hmm. Is going to be limited, and they need folks that are in their area to be able to do that.
I want to thank you both for an excellent conversation. We've been talking about SF4, San Francisco Women Against Rape, now celebrating 50 years of service to the community on a very large scale. They'll be celebrating with a special event that's coming up on the 26th, and you can check out information about that at sfwar.org, sfwar.org. You can find out information about the many programs that we've mentioned here as well. If you have the need of anything from SF4, you can call the hotline. The phone number is 415-647-RAPE. Janelle White, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely, Angie. And, you know, I just got a text message from a very important person reminding me that DJ Lady Ryan will also be DJing for us on April 26th. I know she's got a program on KALW, so I'm sorry for missing that, but I want to hold up DJ Lady Ryan, too.
Brilliant. Thank you. Yes, we're very proud of her. Thank you. And Alicia, thank you so much. I appreciate it as well.
Thank you so much for having us, Angie.
I'm so glad to. If you've missed any part of this show, you can listen to this or any past shows, or you can sign up for our podcast. All of that can be done at yourcallradio.org. You can find us, too, on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Hint, hint. Follow us on what used to be known as Twitter, at yourcallradio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Andrew Stelzer produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Call.